questions haunt every life, writes Andy Crouch. The first, what are we meant to be? And the second, why are we so far from what we're meant to be? Hello and welcome to Restoring the Soul, a podcast dedicated to helping you close the gap from what you're meant to be and what keeps you from being all that. I'm your producer, Brian Beatty. Thank you for listening. Now, in this edition of Restoring the Soul, Michael welcomes Dr. Carolyn Weber to the podcast. Now, the title of today's podcast is Sex and the City of God. And even though the word sex is in the title, as you'll find out in today's spirited conversation, Carolyn's book of the same name is surely and mostly about marriage, what comes before and what we receive afterward. Now, through her personal story, you'll see that Carolyn discovers what life truly looks like when we choose to love God first. Dr. Weber holds her Master's of Philosophy and Doctor of Philosophy from Oxford University, England, and has served as a faculty member at a number of colleges, including Seattle University and Westmont College. Her first memoir, Surprised by Oxford, won, among other distinctions, the Grace Irwin Award, the largest award for Christian writing in Canada. So without any further delay, here's your host, Michael John Cusick.
Carolyn Weber, I want to welcome you to our podcast. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me, Michael. I appreciate it very much.
Hopefully we'll talk about a lot of different things as we touch on your brand new book, Sex and the City of God, a memoir of love and longing. You wrote another book, Surprised by Oxford. For our listeners who may not know you, you have a little bit of education, right? You have a master's and a doctorate from Oxford University, where so much of your story in this book is unpacked. Mm-hmm. You're obviously really, really bright because your writing is just beautiful.
Well, thank you. Oh, you sound like my mom.
Well, I always flip through books and heavily skim them to determine, you know, do I want to actually read this one? And I actually read it cover to cover, and I love good writing, and your doctorate is in classical literature.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you so much. I would hope that I can write a little bit after studying literature, but yes, I did 18th and 19th century literature was my focus, but I've ended up teaching whatever needed to be taught.
And so would 18th century literature include some of the poets that you quote, like Byron and Keats?
Yes. Wordsworth and Shelley, that group, Jane Austen, that group.
And then you flip the page and you're quoting U2 and Paper Tiger and Minnie Me from Austin Powers.
Yeah, I love all literature. I love music. I grew up, my brother's about 12 years older than me, Michael, and he was a disc jockey for a long time. The kind that actually spun records. So I know side B to every side A. So I love music, literature, all sorts of things. I think the Lord speaks to us through all of those things.
Well, I love literature too, but as I flipped through the book before I read it, I thought any person with a doctorate in literature who can quote U2 and say that marriage is a mini me of God's covenant with us, that's pretty good. And so for those who haven't seen Austin Powers, who, by the way, Mike Myers is a Canadian, right? And you're a Canadian.
That's true.
You use the image of Dr. Evil's little doppelganger, Mini-Me. And so Sex and the City of God is all about relationships and longing and your journey. Can we start with just this idea of how marriage is this mini-me of our covenant with God?
Well, I would never have imagined I would have written a book with the word sex in its title, Michael, or with an Austin Powers reference. But I guess the way that you said that, I know before I was a believer, those sort of cliches that floated around about Christianity, you know, being married to Christ or this blessed assurance, those sort of things, they seemed really not just empty to me, but they seemed really almost corny or silly. I didn't understand. And as I became a believer and grew in my faith, I realized what a powerful metaphor marriage is. You know, it runs throughout the Bible, obviously, but that really central intimate relationship that we have with God first, that we're called to have with God first, is the huge thing that, you know, marriage, for example, is a template of. There's, as I said in my book, it's the only relationship, when I really thought about it, that we are called to love another person. We've promised to love another person. But the way that the one covenant echoes the other one, I think, is just incredibly powerful. And but we have to, I think that's why I was also drawn to Augustine, that notion of ordering our loves on that first commandment, you know, to love God first. And again, before I was a Christian, I thought that rang so heavy-handed. I thought God sounded really obsessive or jealous. But I actually have grown to see, too, how beautiful that first commandment is. And that, you know, if we are Christians, if we are following Jesus and we're doing that authentically, we're married then. We're already married, regardless of our relationship status. We've made that commitment to take our decisions and our prayers and our hearts and everything to Him first. And then that colors and shapes all the other ways that we love and interact in relationship.
And I have not read your previous book, Surprised by Oxford, where you got your graduate training and your doctorate. But there's almost a stereotype or a caricaturization that if a person becomes a Christian while they're at Oxford or with that training, that they must have done it because, you know, they got the correct apologetic and came to an intellectual assent. I'm guessing, based on the memoir, that for you, it was more about a wooing of your heart than pure rational 2 + 2 = 4, therefore I'll believe.
I think that's very astute. When I arrived at Oxford, that's why I entitled it Surprised by Oxford, was, you know, an echo later of Lewis, but I wasn't familiar with someone like C.S. Lewis to that extent. I think like many readers, you know, I was familiar with Narnia and that sort of thing, but I didn't know someone like Lewis had become a Christian in Oxford or as the result of that kind of intellectual pursuit. I was studying various religions for my master's at the time, and I had actually a lot of cynicism towards Christianity. There was some intellectual searching for sure and a lot of kicking against it. But ultimately, I was most moved by the Christians I was meeting and how they were living out their faith in their everyday lives. They were by no means perfect as well. We were all sinners. But, you know, Michael, they were sincere. They were earnest. They were asking me questions about my life, about my idea of God. They were inviting. And they had something that I wanted that I couldn't quite figure out what it is that they had. And I think ultimately that's what spoke to me most. And so you can do all the intellectual wrangling in the world, you know, and do all the research and everything that you want. But there is ultimately a decision and also a spiritual leap that you have to take.
So I was originally attracted to your book title because I'm a psychotherapist and I work with sexual issues and I teach on human sexuality at a seminary. At first, I was like, oh, this book isn't really about sex because it doesn't talk about sex per se. But really, the whole book is about sex. If we think of sex as non-genitality, that's a part of it, but that you're describing and unpacking it at a much bigger level. So can you talk about that?
I'm so grateful you would ask me that within that context of what you do, because what you do is very, very important work. I wanted to challenge readers to think about love in a bigger way and to think about our sexuality in a bigger way. And so that's why it's not a book about, I'm by no means a sexpert, and it's not a sex book in terms of how we might categorize that in our market today. I wanted people to be challenged to think about love in a bigger way, relationships in a bigger way, the consequences of our decisions in a bigger way, our bodies as temples, ourselves as belonging to God first. What does that really mean when we live that out? You know, in academia, I have friends of all sexual stripes, and I had my kids that were now entering into becoming teenagers. And, you know, I was really moved to writing this book, Michael, by how many times, you know, we give our kids information, but we don't give them any wisdom. There's a place to talk about purity. There's a place to talk about chastity, those sort of things. But we don't often give people, Christians or non-Christians, students otherwise, the freedom to talk about a lot of other questions within that. So you know, for example, my daughter came home from an event where they were given condoms, but they weren't given any other information. I feel that we don't give our children any other context by which to make viable decisions and relevant decisions and decisions that are part of a larger story of who they are and the consequences for their own hearts, but also for other people that they interact with. There were a lot of other things connected to sexuality and to even abuse that I had been engaged in with friends I knew within my family, that sort of thing as well, that made me think more largely about what is that in our culture that we tend to dismiss or treat so lightly or actually treat in these very kind of limited ways without a larger understanding of God's design or holiness or his love for us in that. And so I just wanted to open more of those conversations and welcome more of those conversations to the table instead of it seeming so black and white or heavy-handed for us as people of faith, but also outside of that.
That's so good. Thank you. These are not your exact words, but a couple of points through the memoir, you talk about how sex is a signpost or a foretaste of our relationship with God. And you do that in a way that doesn't take away from what it is on a human level. But can you talk about that idea that it's a signpost or a foreshadowing?
Yes. I mean, I think on a very physical level, right, in terms of the way that when something is enjoyed and it's been it's enjoyed in an intimate way, it's enjoyed in a safe way. I think that a way in which there's a mutual respect and a holiness around that, that in many ways that is a foretaste of our relationship with God being precious and being something where we can be fully known. I think probably the most basic desire that we have, Michael, is to be known. Is to be fully known. And of course, that's a really loaded word in the Bible. And, you know, when God gives us that white stone with our name on it of acquittal, but also being fully known in Revelation, it points to that idea of being fully known here as well in our relationships. And marriage is the place where that's designed to be so known physically, although there's lots of other places where we have relationship where we can be known in other ways. But I think a signpost in that kind of safety and preciousness with another person in a marriage is really points to that. But I also think that's why, you know, something like the Lord's first miracle is a wedding, happens at a wedding. I mean, there's a lot to be said for old wine tasting best. And the work that's involved in that, you know, the difference that happens when you appreciate something, when you grow in something, and when you grow together in it. And that's not just the physical sex, that's a part of it where there's this intimate and safety, intimacy and safety of it. But there's also the relationship around that and maturing and growing together in that and committing to do that, that colors all of that around it. And that's not taught in our schools. That's not talked about in our larger culture. You know, I can remember one of my most controversial classes I ever taught with some students was these students were really upset about the notion of virtue. They were class hadn't even started yet. And they were talking about who was cheating on whom in Hollywood and wasn't this terrible. And another student piped up and said, and this was at a secular campus, another student piped up and said, well, why would you be bothered by someone cheating on their girlfriend or boyfriend if they don't answer to anything else bigger, or cheating on their marriage if there's no other reason for them to not do so? And there was this huge kerfuffle. I mean, I could barely wrap up the class. And, you know, why do we feel the need to have, you know, to have commitment or to have loyalty or to have all those things that point to what it is where we want to be known and treasured and safe within that relationship? And I think that marriage is one of the places where sex is speaks to that. But as I was also trying to talk about in the book, the decisions in our relationships and how that plays out, you know, the book was also very much shaped by the passing of my father and thinking about, you know, who sits at our deathbeds and who we've shared our bed with as well, physically, or we've chosen not to. And that's very clear in the Bible. I mean, the Bible's full of genealogy as well. You know, that it's a history of sex. And is that just happenstance, or is there some sort of design there? Is there some sort of way that that underscores both our intimate relationship with the Lord, but also our adoptive one?
All of this makes me turn to a line in your book. It's in one of the later chapters, and you said, and how you said this is as rich as what you said, in spite of 100 disadvantages, the world will always return to monogamy. Covenantal sex remembers us. Two questions is, why is it that the world will always return to monogamy, even in light of people who say, you know, there is no need for virtue? And what do you mean by covenantal sex remembers us? That's a play on words, but it sounds really deep.
Remembers us. Well, I love the pun in remember as a hyphenated word, remember. I believe it's a really, really powerful way to think of the word. The word is such a powerful one that obviously Jesus uses, you know, as well in terms of remember me. So there's this physical remembering when your bodies come together that I think really is a foreshadowing or a template or a paradigm for how, for the spiritual remembering. And what I mean by that remembering is, I think it's a lot like C.S. Lewis put it when he was quoting Johnson, you know, people need to be reminded rather than taught. You know, our hearts tend to want to be reminded rather than instructed. That this reminding in who we are, where we came from, what we were created for, whose we are, and whether we look at that within, again, the safety of the, even, you know, the bed, in the marital bed, it's such a powerful metaphor for our relationship in being remembered in God as well. And so I do think that the physical does point to the spiritual. They're connected. I think everything is so much more connected and so much holier than we ever get it credit for. I think we wouldn't be able to take it in if we actually sat and thought about it. So in a way, you know, it's easy for culture or media or whatever to say, oh, it's not that big a deal. It's not that big a deal. But you know, Michael, I've sat with probably hundreds, if not thousands of students or whatnot over the years. And I have never had a single one say to me after a one night stand, regardless of their position in faith, that they felt better, or who has been where they haven't wrestled with how they have felt demeaned when they haven't had a relationship in which they felt really loved and, you know, and treasured and safe in that relationship, especially sexually. And that extends to, right, to the power play whenever it's contorted or used in an awful way as well. So there's, I think remembering, it's a way in which when sex is entered into in the way that it's covenantally designed to be, it does remind you of your commitment in that relationship, but also your commitment to God, even beyond that relationship. Which is the larger one, you know, you're called to love that person because God has called you to do it. It's not just because you're in the mood.
Right, right. I want to come back to Augustine, the great thinker and writer of the church. And the title of your book is Sex in the City of God. And the City of God is obviously his story and his great work. And then, of course, the I'm sure that somewhere along the way you had to play on the words on Sex in the City, the TV program, and there's just so much to it. But, you know, Augustine, for our listeners that don't know about his history, I basically say he was a sex addict before his conversion, and his slow surrender from living a life of indulgence and sexual conquest to surrendering to God. And you quoted his famous line of, give me chastity and continence, but not yet.
But not yet.
So for many people, Augustine brings up this idea of this amazing conversion, but that he went from, in my words, from feasting to fasting, or from indulgence to restraint. And in the memoir, you walk this fine line, and I think you really created and carried this tension of a heart that was very much alive and full of longing and not wanting to suppress that or squelch that, but living within the constraints. It seems sometimes like Augustine went from indulgence to, okay, everything's bad. And you unpack some of this idea of that the loves, the passions need to be in order as opposed to suppressing the passions or killing them off. So comment on that tension and how you arrived at his City of God as the template.
Yeah, because it is quite the big work. And yet I found it really still very relevant. You know, I mean, there's always points of debate, but still very relevant to us today. You know, these saints were not just random people that have no bearing on our lives. These are people that suffered and went through great things themselves. And I think for later converts, maybe I resonate with him because, you know, his mom prayed for him his whole life. So I have a soft spot for that. But also because I think when you're a later convert, I know at least for me, you are given the gift of looking at what you were in, what you were going through before, what your life was before, and what you don't want in light of what you do have now in Christ. And, you know, everyone's a Peter or a Paul or somewhere in the spectrum. And for those of us who are Pauls, it's very clear what didn't work. And so I can see how he would have gone quite far the other way. But I also, I mean, yes, I was playing a bit on the title of Sex and the City, you know, from the very famous HBO series, because I would also get students, Michael, coming to me and saying, well, this is what I think sex is. This is what, you know, or what relationships are. This is always the messaging out there that I should be more laid about, back about this, or, you know, that it's absolutely fine that it's casual, or it's even cool to act in this way. And the interesting thing, I mean, there's so many sins and, you know, sex in many ways gets a disproportionate amount, but I think with of attention, but I think with the sexual sins, because it's so overtly consumes someone else, you know, I really see the first sin in the Garden of Eden as really being the act of consumption, right? You know, of consuming someone else in order to try and fill yourself. And so it involves also the spirit and the body of someone else. It's not just against yourself. So there's a lot of repercussions for it. And I had an epigraph at the beginning of the book from Candace Bushnell, who'd written Sex in the City. And it says, these days, everyone has friends and colleagues. No one really has lovers, even if they've slept together. And I put that next to the quotation from Augustine, because I just thought it's so incredibly sad, really. And we don't speak about the sadness. We don't speak about the emptiness of that. We speak about it being hip or cool or whatever. We don't actually speak about really how desperately sad that is. And that, you know, there is another way of being. There is another way of thinking of our bodies and thinking of our relationships to relationship. And that other way is Jesus and his teachings. He is the way, but, you know, in many ways, it seems like another way. And but that it's not even brought up as a viable option, you know, in mainstream media or conversations or anything else, let alone in our schools or whatnot. And so, you know, yes, it's kind of setting those two things together in what might seem like a really tricky metaphysical conceit that they don't belong together, you know, something like Augustine's work and an HBO series. But I actually wanted to throw them together to get people to think about the two different cities, you know, and what citizenship are you? You know, there's the City of God, which is eternal and has this design and has this beauty and has this plan and has this thought for what relationship means. And there's the City of Man, which is temporal and emptier. You know, the two are called to live in peace together, as Augustine says, but they have very different theological ends. And that makes all the difference.
Because you said you grew up with your brother being a DJ, I'm going to tell you this, and I think this would probably be a little bit of an offensive thing to say to an author, and especially somebody with an Oxford literary degree. I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, just across the lake from you all in Canada, and rock and roll was a big part of my life. And Bruce Springsteen was introduced there very early. And in his memoir, he wrote that every one of his songs, and he's written over 5,000 songs, that every one of his songs came down to addressing one of three questions. What do you do when your dreams come true? What do you do when your dreams don't come true? And is love real? And as I got to the end of your book, and if I were to show it to you, it's highlighted and there's folded ears, I thought, to me, that's how your memoir spoke to me. You wrestled with, can my longings be fulfilled? And after one relationship, do I even dare to long again and open myself up to that? And how do I live in this tension between God should be the satisfaction versus a human being? What do you do when your dreams don't come true? And then is love real? And I want to throw that out to see how those three questions, how you think that might relate to your book.
Oh, wow. Those are three terrific questions, right, for all of us. You know, when my father was dying, he said, life doesn't turn out as planned. He loves Springsteen a lot, so it's interesting you should say that. Our dreams are obviously important, but they shift and morph and change on this side of heaven. And they're whimsical, you know, and I think, sometimes I know I've had lots of girlfriends or students or whatever that will say to me, Michael, you know, if I can just meet the right guy, it would be perfect. Right. You know, that grass is always greener, you know, there. And then on the other side in marriage, when, you know, you can love someone desperately or not or whatever, and have all sorts of issues and problems in marriage as well. Like there's not on this side of heaven, I think, anywhere to hide from ourselves. Except in that first commandment. And what's hard is, you know, basically since the fall, we can't see God tangibly. We have to live by faith. And we're promised that we will, that those things will be revealed to us. And we're promised all these things that if we were to take them at real value, they change everything. Yeah, dreams morph and shift and change. And they're really, I think, things that I know when I read scripture, again, that remembers me, that realigns me into actually the reality of being loved by God and what he has planned for all of us. And as opposed to it being a dream, that really real. And is love real? It is when we do, again, remember that God's behind all of it. You know, when I think about being called to love the person that we are in relationship with as God has loved them. And we think about that commandment that Jesus says is actually, you know, love one another as I've loved you and love God with all you have. That's a really key central commandment that underscores that first commandment. And it does change everything because then nothing is wasted. You know, I think so often we want to love and have something back in return. That's very human. You know, look, I'm loving you. I'm trying so hard. I'm doing this. I'm doing that. But grace doesn't operate according to that at all. You know, grace isn't karma and grace isn't accumulative and grace isn't dependent on whether you want to love me back or however. And that's just mind blowing if we actually stop and think about what grace really is. And so when we're called to love in that way, we might never on this side of heaven see the fruits of that or recognize or, you know, doesn't mean we have to suffer in that sense, but there's this way in which, you know, we are called to love someone else as we've been loved, withholding judgment. And, you know, I guess I think about like what Peter Kreft said, you know, life is fatal and we're all going to die. And I think that's the big philosophical question. It was what happens to us when we die. And I think that's the eternality of love is the eternal part of that we are loving past ourselves. We love past people, past things into loving God beyond that. And that's also what orders our loves too.
As we wrap up, just a final question. You had one of my favorite Augustine quotes. I heard it early on, back in the early 80s, by a pastor say, love God and do as you please. And you gave the whole quote in the context, and it was love and do what you will. So in light of what you just said about loving and the power of that and that it's eternal and we might not see it, what does that mean to you, to love and do what you will?
For me, I've become so dependent on prayer, Michael. I think because I used to be, again, cynical about prayer. I thought, you know, what does it really mean? It seems to be answering nothing or doing nothing, especially before I was a believer. But love and do what you will, when you really set your heart to love God, really try earnestly to love God and then pray for wisdom, because I'm amazed that, you know, he says over and over again, you'll be given wisdom when you ask for it. It's right there for the taking. It's right when you open your door, hoping that that would temper any mistake I would do on this end in not loving in the best way, because it is hard to know how best to love. I mean, you know, you take somebody who's codependent, right? You take somebody who's helping an addict or anything else, but you think maybe you're doing the best thing by handing them something. What is the best way to love? And you can have all forms of that. We're all addicted to something. It just, you can move into the slot, whatever it is. So what is the best way to love? What is the best way to show God's love and to really try to seek God's love? And then I think by saying then love and do what you will, hopefully you're moving in that direction. You're moving towards enacting on being led by love, leading with love. And it can sound very John Lennon. It can sound very cliche, but actually I think for thoughtful Christians who are really trying to discern what scripture promises and is teaching us and really trying to be open to the Holy Spirit, there is a way in which there's incredible power and wisdom that's available to us.
Your new book is Sex in the City of God, a memoir of love and longing. And Carolyn Weber, I sure appreciate you today taking the time to not just talk about the book, but all of these ideas that are so encouraging and helpful. So bless you.
Oh, thank you so much. God bless you too and your good work.
So thank you for listening to another episode of Restoring the Soul. We want you to know that Restoring the Soul is so much more than a podcast. What we're all about is helping couples and individuals get unstuck. You know how some people go to counseling or marriage therapy for months or even years and never really get anywhere? Our intensive programs help clients get unstuck in as little as 2 weeks. To learn more, visit RestoringTheSoul.com. That's RestoringTheSoul.com.
You already know we live in a pornified world, but most of us are at a loss for how to navigate this sea of temptation. It's either ceaseless striving on the one hand or giving in to brokenness on the other. But doesn't the gospel offer us another way? The truth is that our sexual struggles are not actually about sex, but about a misdirected, God-given longing for deep connection. Dig deeper in my book, Surfing for God, Discovering the Divine Desire Beneath Sexual Struggle.